This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Occasionally something happens here on Earth that's so big you can see it from space. That happened this week as satellites tracked the toxic air that choked Delhi in India, closing schools and forcing cars off the road. Elsewhere, the crisis in Haiti nears a boiling point. The death of U.S. citizens in Mexico reignites the debate over drug cartels. There's a peace deal in Yemen. And the first black South African rugby captain lifts the championship trophy as the Springboks win the World Cup. Plenty to discuss on the Friday News Roundup. And joining us here in studio is Nancy Youssef, national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Joining us from NPR in New York is Hayes Brown, the deputy world news editor for BuzzFeed News. Hayes, welcome.
Glad to be here.
And for the first time here in person is Michael Goldfarb, the host of the podcast First Rough Draft of History. Michael, normally we talk to you from London, but welcome to Washington.
It's good to see that you really are you.
I really am, and you are really you.
It's amazing.
It is indeed, and I would be amazed to hear your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories from around the world. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Let's begin in India, where the capital is being smothered by smog. Severe air pollution has transformed New Delhi into what one city official called a gas chamber. Reporter Neha Masi recently spoke to Morning Edition from there.
I would say it's quite dystopian. Yesterday was one of the worst days that we've had, not just this year, but in the last over the last few years. There was like a really, really thick ball of smoke, gray smoke, all over the city. You couldn't see skyscrapers, you couldn't see national monuments. The air had a noxious, almost pungent smell that makes eyes water. You cough even if you have no respiratory issues. You feel breathless if you stay outdoors too much. It reminded me of Mordor from Lord of the Rings.
Now that's vivid. Neha Masi spoke to Morning Edition this week from New Delhi. Nancy Youssef, how did it get so Mordor-like? I mean, we've heard about air pollution problems in India before. That's not new, but why is it so bad now?
Well, there's a winter haze. I mean, the city of Delhi goes through some variation of this every year, but this year it's been markedly worse, and in part because they've never really dealt with some of the issues at hand. You've heard, despite all the complaints about the levels of pollution, there hasn't been a real offering of solutions. And I think in the past, things like this have happened for a few weeks period of time, and then it subsides, and so does these sort of concerns and issues that come with it. And so this year, it just became more pronounced as the environmental issues have gotten worse, and India's government and its citizens haven't sort of seen this as an issue that has to be addressed or treated as a priority.
How much more broadly is this air pollution problem? Is it affecting other cities or countries nearby?
Well, I mean, according to one estimate of the 30 most polluted cities in the world, 22 of them are in India. So that gives you a sense of sort of the scale of the environmental issues that that country, a country of 1 billion, is facing.
Michael, there was a report this week that came out in the journal Bioscience. More than 11,000 scientists warning the world that we are in for what they described as untold suffering if we do not do more to fight climate change. It seems, Michael, like we're getting one of these we're all going to die reports pretty much every month. Not that they're false, but it starts to feel a bit like a drumbeat. And I wonder what impact that has on actually making policy to do something.
Well, this is not a new policy area, is it, Josh? We've had London has been brought to a halt a couple of times in the last couple of months by Extinction Rebellion. It's a protest group, and they really do bring the city to a halt. A couple of weeks ago, they were all arrested, and just 2 days ago, I think, the High Court ruled that the police had acted unlawfully, and these people were allowed to go out and protest and bring the city to a halt. And what I find problematic is that their approach to educating the public is we're all going to die. But, you know, we've had Rio, we've had the Paris Agreement, we've had a variety of initiatives. You know, 30 years ago, the ozone hole, and suddenly nobody used aerosol cans anymore. And in fact, it's slowly starting to repair. So in terms of policy, it is out there. In terms of India, what you've got are these megacities, but there's no zone of difference. You go from the megacity, you go to an agrarian area, and part of the big contributor to this week's smog is they're burning stubble. I've been in Cairo at stubble burning season, and you cannot see the pyramids from the citadel, which is almost impossible. And I've been in Delhi at stubble burning season, and it gets really, really rough. So what are you going to tell people not to burn the stubble when they've brought in their crops? I don't know.
Well, in Hayes, beyond that, the study's signatories come from more than 150 countries, but I'm not sure exactly how many countries would need to get on board with these measures, particularly since the U.S. has officially told the U.N. that it's going to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement.
Right. And this is the soonest that the Trump administration could do so after announcing that they were planning to last year. The Paris Climate Agreement has a lengthy period where countries have to really think about it before they withdraw fully from the agreement. So the Trump administration kicked off a 1-year period where they have until they're officially out. So that'll be after the 2020 election. So it remains to be seen what will happen with that. But opponents of the Paris Climate Agreement in the U.S., it's funny, they seem to have it both ways in their head. It's either a completely toothless, you know, international agreement that's not really going to do anything to fix the problem, so why should we be in it? But it's also an extreme left-wing radical way of fighting climate change that's going to strangle business and choke economies around the world. And so it's really neither things are true. It's an entirely voluntary agreement. You have to set their own goals for what sort of climate change action they're going to take. And most countries around the world have set relatively moderate goals, but they're still looking to the United States for leadership. So plan Bs are being worked on for what happens if this giant climate agreement goes into place without one of the largest emitters in the world signed on.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, Nancy, is how much can we actually get done without buy-in from the U.S.? I mean, the U.S. is already the world's number two emitter of carbon dioxide. China is far and away number one. They have almost twice the volume of CO2 emissions. Does this really hinge on the United States, the Paris Climate Agreement, or are the other countries making enough progress that it would still be worthwhile?
I think what we've seen so far is that the absence of the United States, not just by deciding to withdraw, but its lack of engagement has already shown its effects. We've seen most of these countries haven't agreed to sort of set emission standards or change them or accelerate the pace at which they reduce their emissions footprint. And I think part of that is the absence of the world's largest economy. You've seen an increased sort of pressure on countries like China and India to sort of step up and fill and sort of acknowledge vacuum that happens with the absence of the United States. You mentioned earlier about how we've seen these kinds of announcements in the past. I think what's we're seeing, and in fact, this was on the 40th anniversary of the first climate change conference in Geneva, so that gives you a sense of how long these issues have been at the forefront. I think the biggest difference we're seeing is how the public is responding, particularly here, even since the 2016 election, and where that issue is now in the 2020 election. You see it as a more prevalent issue. We're hearing from the youth. We're seeing more global protests. So while you're right to point out that the issues raised aren't necessarily new, and in fact, many of the same scientists raised the issues in a previous report just a couple years earlier, you're seeing it grow as a priority for voters, particularly in this country, and in terms of impact all over the world.
And Michael, it's interesting that the U.S. is pulling out. China remains in. It is far and away the number one emitter of CO2. It seems like this is just one more way that China is increasing influence in a variety of ways, including on something existential like the climate crisis.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And there are other geopolitical areas where the U.S. is withdrawing and China is being seen as the country that you really need to do business with in order to achieve your own more local goals. What I find really interesting about this is that, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, when these big agreements were being negotiated, it was at the high noon of globalism. And you had elites, I hate that word, but I mean, that's who and what they are, negotiating all the time amongst each other on a wide range of issues. And I don't know how you deal with a planet-wide emergency with nationalist politicians who will say, well, my borders stop here and my interest in the world stops here, as, you know, the United States is doing by giving notice of withdrawing from this UN treaty.
Nancy?
Can I just offer one theory that we've heard is that I think one of the reasons that people were reticent to make changes is that there was a fear that it would have an environmental impact, that businesses would be affected, that sort of voters would say, I don't want to have to pay a heavy price personally for helping the environment. And I think what we're seeing now in places like India with the California wildfires is that now there actually is a price for not doing anything. And arguably that's the shift that will happen to lead to change. Maybe, and as Michael points out, maybe it's not on the sort of national scale in terms of politics, but we're seeing it in local communities by individuals more so than we are sort of seeing leaders step forward and as nation states.
We have to move on in just a second, but Hayes, where does this go from here with the incredible smog in Delhi, with the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement? What's next?
I think what's next is we are going to see, like Nancy was saying, a real shift as people realize that not doing anything is going to hurt way more than just letting this happen to us. Like, I think that when you see things like the Green New Deal being pushed in Congress as sort of a maximalist idea of what we can do to actually have an impact, that it starts to move the Overton window on what can be done. I think the real big step is going to be when corporations realize, oh, we don't just have to talk about green policies, we have to actually enact them.
More of the Friday News Roundup to come with Hayes Brown of BuzzFeed News, Nancy Youssef of The Wall Street Journal, and Michael Goldfarb of the podcast First Rough Draft of History. Tomorrow is the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. For David Hasselhoff, that was a reason to throw a now legendary concert. Here's his hit from 1989 called Looking for Freedom. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. Someday. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Hayes Brown of BuzzFeed News, Nancy Youssef of the Wall Street Journal, and Michael Goldfarb, the host of the podcast First Rough Draft of History. We'd love your questions and thoughts about the top stories from around the world, so comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Let's head now to Mexico, where 9 U.S. citizens were killed, 6 children and 3 women. A relative of the victims posted a disturbing video to Facebook after the attack.
This is for the record. Nita and 4 of my grandchildren are burnt and shot up right on the road out of La Mora.
La Mora is a small town in Mexico where a fundamentalist community of Americans has settled. Hayes Brown, what do we know about this attack, particularly who might be responsible for it?
We know a lot about the horrific details, unfortunately, where numerous women and children of the same family were killed, Mormons living on the Mexico-U.S. border, dual citizens of the U.S. and Mexico. We know that it's likely related to cartel violence, considering that the family has been threatened by drug cartels in Mexico over the years several times. But the Mexican authorities, they arrested someone who they believed was involved in the actual killing, but had to release this person because they could not connect them to the killing. It has inspired a lot of, you know, hand-wringing in the United States over what to do. The president has said, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas has said, well, maybe we need to go and actually punish these cartels for these sorts of actions across the border into Mexico, which had a lot of people going, wait, that's probably not the best idea. It's a part of a rise in violence that we've seen in Mexico over the last few months as the cartels seem to be pushing harder and harder to reinstate themselves in northern Mexico.
Yeah, Michael, I was just going to ask you your thoughts about what this tells us about cartel violence in Mexico today and what that means for us in the U.S. Roberto tweeted, things to keep in mind when talking about drug trafficking in Mexico. The war has been going on for years. Many Mexican children have also died, and hundreds of thousands along the border are binational. So this is indeed a binational problem that is on our radar in the U.S. now for a somewhat unique reason, but this violence is not new by the slightest.
No, it's not new. And what's interesting is the Mexican press is obviously in a better position to delve into what really was going on. And this family, the LeBaron family, this Mormon family, had been there a very long time and apparently involved in politics. One of them, one of the members of the family is actually a member of PRI, the political party that's ruled Mexico for most of its existence. And there's some inference that it might not just be drug cartel violence, but there might be other political issues involved in the family being targeted. But in terms of what happens down there, I mean, anyone who's listening and who's had the pleasure of driving along the border in the border region, because it's a great place to visit, the weather's always good, is that the back and forth is constant. And I've always felt it's a little odd when Washington politicians, national politicians, make a thing about, oh, we're being invaded by Mexicans. I mean, the year that I reported from down there were like 22 million legal crossings. People just wander in from Juarez into El Paso every day to shop and to work. So anyway, in terms of the drug violence, I think that this is yet another example of how in this country, in this society, and I can see it because I live overseas and have done for 35 years, people just don't pay attention when they see a problem anymore. And the growth of drug trafficking across that border for a quarter of a century, as it's got increasingly violent, has never been addressed.
So, Nancy, what does that tell us about what the Mexican and U.S. governments might do? I mean, in recent months, President Trump has been able to exert tangible pressure on the Mexican government in terms of dealing with immigration at the border. Mexico created this new, like, law enforcement force that didn't exist as part of a deal with the U.S. Does that, I mean, how have the Mexican and U.S. governments responded? Do they know what to do?
So Mexico has sent additional forces into Lamora, but I think there's an expectation that that is only going to be a temporary approach and that they will not have the resources to sustain a presence there. And in fact, they have had security shortages throughout the country, which is one of the ways this has become a growing problem, especially in the last year. The president has sort of called for, of this country, has called for the Mexicans to do something. He tweeted that out shortly after this horrific attack. But in terms of the specifics, it's been very hard to sort out because we're talking about a rampant problem and very limited resources. And I think one of the shocks of this attack among many was this, there had been a notion up until this point that these Mormon communities and rival drug cartels had somehow found a way to peacefully coexist relatively. And as it turns out, there is no way to sort of come up with a solution between residents because at some point, and we've seen it in the last few months, this is an escalating crisis, an escalating drug war, and civilians can find themselves in the middle of something that they had no intention of being in the middle of.
Before we move on, Michael, briefly.
Just quickly, I mean, the upsurge coincides with the conviction of El Chapo in a Brooklyn courtroom, and the big violence, and as terrible as the events last week were, is what happened in Culiacan mm-hmm. a couple of weeks ago when his son was arrested and they went to war with the government, and the government backed down and released his son.
There's a story we've wanted to talk about for a while, and it's the crisis in Haiti. This has gotten worse over the past several weeks. Violent demonstrations are continuing there. There's an opposition movement that's been pushing to oust the president, Jovenel Moise. According to Amnesty International, at least 35 people have died through mid-October in the protests, maybe more. Hayes, bring us up to speed on these protests, why they broke out, what it is that the protesters want from President Moise, and you know whether it's clear that they might get it.
So for the last few years, Mr. Moise has been in power. He's had sort of a tenuous grasp, considering you know he was accused of fraud during his election. And part of the issue with anyone who's running Haiti is trying to turn around the economy of a country that has been plagued by not just rampant earthquakes, as we saw in 2010, but also with a lot of corruption and a lot of resources being taken over the centuries from them. I think that the problems that he's been facing have been economic in nature and stagnation, spiral inflation, food and drinking water scarcities, and just a sense of lingering miasma over the country that these protests are a clear response to. They're trying to get him out of office. But what happens after that? Question mark, question mark, question mark.
Yeah, yeah. And what part does the U.S. play in the crisis in Haiti, either in terms of where it goes from here or how it got to this point?
I mean, the United States and Haiti have been inextricably linked since the late 1800s. The United States has been a true force in trying to shape Haiti's destiny, even to the detriment of the Haitians. So throughout the 90s, we saw, you know, the United States taking a strong hand in intervening within Haiti and pushing for different political figures to rise and fall in power. And the people of Haiti are kind of sick of that.
Emily emailed, "I was so happy to hear you mention Haiti, as it's very dear to my heart and what's going on is tragic. Thank you for providing a much needed service." Nancy, you wanted to jump in.
Well, you know, I thought Hayes brought up such a great point, and in particular about what happens next, because I think one of the problems is that there isn't an agreement among the protesters about what happens if you remove him from power. And I couldn't help but look at these protests in the context of the ones that are happening in Chile, in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Hong Kong, in Algeria, and the common thread that there's a rejection of the corruption within those governments. And I think that's something that goes through Haiti as well. And also the sort of relative silence of the United States and Europe and other world leaders to this call for major reforms in the structure of governments and economic reforms, major changes to these countries. I think what you hear in all these protests is it's not enough to just remove the person. We want to see institutional changes as well.
Well, Michael, this is also somewhat political. I mean, you know, there was a report that some Senate Democrats have released that kind of claims that part of the issue with Haiti's temporary protected status and having to release certain Haitians or keep them in the country had some political motivations related to the 2020 election.
Entirely possible. One of the things that I've noticed over the years when I've dealt with societies and countries that are, you know, in constant crisis is that when the big brother countries like the United States or whoever it might be, they begin to, it's not that they interfere so much in internal things, but they try to put structures in. But after 3 or 4 years, those structures themselves become corrupted. And, you know, it is very, very difficult when you've been in a position, as the United States has been with Haiti, not to actually become a player in continuing corruption, because it's a Mobius strip. The corruption starts one place, goes to the next, and comes back.
Let's move now to Brazil, where clashes between indigenous communities and loggers in the Amazon rainforest have gotten more violent. Last week, illegal loggers killed an indigenous leader. Logging has gotten more frequent under the leadership of Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro. He's pushed to roll back environmental protections and expand commercial exploitation of the Amazon. Hayes, what does this tell us about what's happening in Brazil, particularly how Brazilians have responded to the killing?
So the fact of the matter is that Bolsonaro's policies have, like you said, really pushed businesses and others, sustenance farmers in Brazil, to really go further and deeper into the Amazon with their logging and with their clearing brush for land. And the fact that the indigenous peoples living in the Amazon feel the need to form these guardians of the Amazon-like groups to actually ambush and take on these illegal loggers, it shows that the government is not able or willing to deal with these issues. The fact that they're resorting to this sort of vigilante sort of violence in order to be able to protect their communities and protect the resources that allow them to survive and thrive, it just really shows that there's no will from Bolsonaro's government to actually take action against these people who are breaking Brazilian law.
Well, and Michael, I don't hear much will from the international community either in terms of saying, we really do, like all of us really do need the Amazon. Please do something about this.
Well, it goes back to the first topic we were discussing. You know, again, this is when Bolsonaro, he's like Donald Trump in some ways. I mean, if he says it, he means it.
Well, and overtly, he's made some linkage. I don't think he would balk at that.
He didn't care. I mean, he knew that, you know, whatever under the Lula and Dilma Rousseff, whatever kind of ceasing of cutting down the Amazon had happened, he said, I don't care. I'm going to do this. And because, like Donald Trump, he uses certain kinds of language which kind of you know, puts people in the frame of mind to say, well, I can take what I want. I can be aggressive. I can be a racist. I can be whatever. And that is what's happening. That's why why the indigenous communities feel under threat. They've got to fight back. And it cuts across into other areas as well. I mean, yesterday, Glenn Greenwald, you know, the journalist, was assaulted on national television because he's you know, a big critic of Bolsonaro, and some pro-Bolsonaro guy. They were in a studio, you know, leaped across and apparently slapped him, or seen the reports anyway. And, you know, this is as much a Bolsonaro problem as anything. If you aggressively say, oh, cut down the Amazon, I don't care, let the world whatever, this is what happens.
One more story in Latin America that I think matters to anybody who's watched a lot of Spanish language television. The world of Spanish language TV is remembering a very familiar face known for some opulent costumes and uplifting horoscopes.
Yo soy Walter Mercado. It's going to be the beginning of the golden age.
TV astrologer Walter Mercado died on Sunday at the age of 88. He got his start at a station in Puerto Rico 50 years ago. At the height of his career, he reached 120 million people in many parts of Latin America. His hands were lined with rings, he had a cape on his back, and he would sign off with the catchphrase, Sobre todos, mucho, mucho amor, meaning, above all, lots and lots of love. It's the Friday News Roundup with Michael Goldfarb, Hayes Brown, and Nancy Youssef. We welcome your questions and thoughts about the week's top stories, 1A@WAMU.org. Also glad to get some of your recollections of where you were when the Berlin Wall came down. Mayu tweeted, I lived in West Germany for junior year abroad the year the wall came down. My East German lit class became a current events class as the Velvet Curtain came down. Friends handed out bananas to fruitless East Berliners. Thank you for sharing that memory with us. We welcome more of them, 1A@WAMU.org. Let's talk Yemen, where the Saudi-backed government signed a peace deal with separatists in the south on Tuesday. It's a move to try to end the conflict in southern Yemen. Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, said the agreement was a step forward in ending it. He said in a televised signing ceremony, quote, this agreement will open, God willing, broader talks between Yemeni parties to reach a political solution and end the war, unquote. Now, Nancy, some experts have been skeptical that this will actually stop the fighting, I think with good reason. What is in this peace deal that might give supporters hope that the fighting would stop?
Well, to back up briefly, the separatists were backed by the UAE, and one of the most sort of noteworthy things that they were able to do is take control of the city of Aden in August, and that was sort of what gave them leverage. And remember that up until 1990, there was a South Yemen, and so there is a historical precedence is there as well.
Aden is that port city that in southern Yemen that's kind of the entryway for supplies and food and
so forth.
That's
right. That's exactly right. And so for the Saudis, this was an important deal because it was really showed infighting between the sort of Sunni states as they're taking on the Iranian-backed Houthis. And so if you're an optimist, you say that it's removed a war within the war, or at least dealt with it for now. Longer term, I think there's reason to be worried because what it really does is kind of kick the problem down the road. Those who believe in a sort of separatist South Yemen aren't going to necessarily be pleased with this deal because it really doesn't deal with core issues. It says that within 30 days that you'll have equal representatives in a newly formed government, but I'm not sure that that's what the separatists are looking for. They are laying the groundwork for potentially a South Yemen, and it doesn't deal with it just horrible human rights and humanitarian crisis that's happening in Yemen. I think if you're an optimist, you say this dealt with one subsect of this war. I think if you're a pessimist, you say this was a kicking of the can of a real issue that will come up down the road, and it doesn't really fundamentally change the plight of more than 24 million people living in Yemen.
Much more to discuss when we continue with Nancy Youssef, Hayes Brown, and Michael Goldfarb. Some other cultural stories we want to talk about, including with the South African rugby team that made history this week, a little bit more on the remembrance of the fall of the Berlin Wall, and also in Manchester, England, speaking of cultural stories, there's a last-ditch effort to save a piece of the musical history of the Bee Gees. The Gaumont Cinema was where they made their live debut in 1957. Back then, they were called the Rattlesnakes. Today, that building is a funeral home, and it's up for sale. volunteers have launched a campaign. You can guess what the campaign is called. The goal is to raise $300,000 to transform that building into a food hall and a performance space. We'll get back to the Friday News Roundup in just a moment. Send your questions and stories, 1A at WAMU.org. Back now to the Roundup with Hayes Brown, Nancy Youssef, and Michael Goldfarb. Y'all have been sending in some good, interesting questions about what's going on in Mexico, so we'll back up to that in a little bit. I want to get to some of those questions before our time is up. But first, let's continue with our section in the Middle East. And Hayes, there was a very interesting story with the Justice Department this week because they have charged two former employees of Twitter here in the U.S. with spying for Saudi Arabia. The department accused them of obtaining information on American citizens and on opponents of the Saudi regime. What do we know about these guys? Who they are, how they got the access, whether or not they actually are Saudi spies? What do we know?
So we know that there's two people who work for Twitter who were charged in this Justice Department memo who worked for Twitter, one of whom was a U.S.-based engineer who, in his role, was able to see everything about a user's data, basically. Your IP address, which is where you're tweeting from, what browser you're using, when you're logged on. And these two people were recruited and courted, apparently, according to the Justice Department, to take the information that they could glean and report it back to Saudi Arabia. This was dangerous for a couple of different reasons. One, because you shouldn't be able to have this access through a U.S. company passed on to the government of a foreign government. That just doesn't work well, especially since you're looking at U.S. citizens. But also, what's interesting is that they were allegedly courted and recruited by someone close with ties to the Saudi royal family. And a lot of people are speculating that one of the royals deeply involved is Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, who has been in the news far too much over the last year for shady dealings, including the allegedly, I'm going to put allegedly in there, being behind the death of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist last year.
Yeah, Nancy Youssef, this is another example of, something questionable surrounding Mohammed bin Salman, also of another country exploiting an American social media platform, though this time from within. Have we heard anything from either Saudi Arabia or from Twitter about all this?
We haven't heard anything from the Saudis. The one other thing I would add is I found it interesting that it happened so soon after MBS came to power. This was 2015, 2016. This is very early on in his tenure. And it said to me that this sort of need to go after or target or learn more about dissidents started almost from the onset of his tenure. And it also said to me that, Saudi Arabia, I think, looks at Twitter as a form of public space, a kind of public space that Saudis generally don't enjoy the freedoms of in their own country, and that there was a need to sort of regulate it and monitor it.
Michael?
What's interesting is I was in Saudi Arabia in 2003, a few months after the overthrow of Saddam, and I made an hour-long program about life in Saudi, and at the end of it, I didn't have enough tape because no one will talk to you. So I went back to London and I found a Saudi dissident. Now, this is pre-Twitter, but every day he would broadcast and put it up, YouTube, or it would be retransmitted throughout the Middle East. He was knifed on his doorstep in London. The Saudi regime tries to keep an incredibly tight hold on its population. And MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, is on the one hand trying to say, well, I'm a modernizer. On the other hand, he is potentially he's the crown prince of an absolute monarchy. People forget it's basically a feudal monarchy, even with all the jets that they fly around in. And they will control what everybody has to say. And in fact, the man who got me my press visa to go and report in Saudi Arabia was Jamal Khashoggi, and he told me when in the embassy, this is in 2003, we have to stop being afraid. And I think it's really clear that Mohammed bin Salman has not stepped forward enough, and there's still this fear that if you let these tens of millions of Saudi citizens speak freely, what will that do to our position as the royal family. So he hasn't quite got there. And I know we're about to talk about, I think, the IPO.
Yeah.
And I think it leads into the IPO. And in fact, Stephen Cook in Foreign Policy Today has an excellent article about that, which is they're going to sell off maybe 2-3% of their holding in Aramco. But do you want to go into business with a ruler who actually hasn't quite stepped away from this absolute monarchy idea?
Yeah, Hayes, I was just going to ask you about that in terms of Saudi Arabia moving forward. It's got plans to sell shares of Aramco, which is its state oil company. It could make Aramco bigger than Apple in terms of stock terms. So you've got this dichotomy, right? You've got Mohammed bin Salman and this very controlling, in ways, highly repressive regime. But at the same time, he's been courting world markets, trying to get the world to do more business in Saudi Arabia. President Trump famously made a trip there early. I think it was his first foreign trip. He went to Saudi Arabia. Yep. So there's this dichotomy going on.
Yeah. For all of MBS's faults, and they are many, it seems, he's no dummy when it comes to realizing that as the world changes and as the world moves away from fossil fuels, Saudi Arabia needs to diversify its economy, needs to find new ways of bringing money into the kingdom. It's not sustainable for Saudi Arabia to just have Aramco be solely controlled by the Saudi royal family and have that be the way that they can continue to move forward. So he knows that. And so he's been trying to schmooze with tech leaders in Silicon Valley. He's been, this offering of stock within Aramco, it's really like almost too good a deal for a lot of investors to pass up, because you know that the oil is going to keep flowing from Saudi Arabia. You know that the Saudi government is going to do whatever it can to keep its profits high. And if you don't care what those methods are, then why not buy into this? It's not like they're going to sell off. It's not like the Saudis are going to sell off enough of Aramco stock that it's going to have any influence. It's not like they're going to really follow by any sort of international standards in terms of how the board should be composed and how decisions are made and how profits flow out. No, if you buy into Aramco, you are saying, well, I'm going to make a profit, so may as well.
One more story out of the Middle East, Nancy, and it has to do with Syria. The senior U.S. diplomat in northern Syria is a guy named William Roebuck, and he criticized the Trump administration for not doing more to prevent Turkey from invading Syria last month. You may remember there was that deal to kind of create a so-called safe zone in northern Syria. Turkey and Syria share a north-south border, and this was basically on the border where Syria becomes Turkey. And when that deal was reached, Turkish forces moved in to go after Kurdish forces who had been helping the U.S. fight terror. William Roebuck's criticisms came in an internal memo that the New York Times obtained. What's the significance of this memo, other than the fact that he's just, going against publicly or making a public stance against the Trump administration's policy?
Well, it was a very damning document. It was a very detailed, well-written document from a top State Department official at a time when there was tension between the State Department and the president. And he outlines in very clear terms, I think, what you hear from a lot of U.S. officials who oppose the U.S. decision to withdraw its troops. And he spells it out, and he talks, and he you can feel an almost personal anguish over the abandonment of the Kurds. He talks about the threat of intention-laced ethnic cleansing. I mean, he's personally concerned, is one of the things that you get across from the document. He talks about the U.S. influence or lack thereof with the U.S. movement of troops. He addresses the U.S. decision to then return troops back in to protect the oil and whether that gives the United States leverage and with the practicalities of it. He talks about the challenges of going after the Islamic State in the absence of a U.S. presence there. And so I think that it was a very big deal here, because we hadn't really seen it spelled out in one document in such a succinct way from the State Department at a time when the tensions are already there.
We mentioned that this week marks the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in Germany this week for that commemoration, when communist East Germany reunited with the freer West Germany. Former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev sat down with the BBC for an interview timed to this occasion. Gorbachev said that today's tension between Russia and the West is, in his words, a colossal danger because of nuclear weapons. Thanks also to those of you who shared your memories about the falling of the Berlin Wall. Jorge emailed, "I live in Wichita, and our local museum has a piece of the Berlin Wall on display. Don't tell anyone, but I've rubbed the wall because I wanted to touch a piece of history. So the FCC has a rule that says we have to discuss Brexit every week. This is the only reason why you're here from London.
I know, and I appreciate the first class airfare. Thank you.
Exactly. Besides, Nancy, we wanted to spare her because I see her shaking her head right now. She's like, please don't make. But this week there was some more public comment from very high up EU officials in terms of the UK's plan to leave the EU. Jean-Claude Juncker is the outgoing European Union chief. He's clearly had enough of it. He told the BBC, quote, "This is a too long story. It has to be brought to an end," unquote. The deadline was supposed to be October 31st. That didn't happen. Now it's been pushed back somewhere. Maybe December. There's an election coming up. I mean, it would seem like the EU is done with extensions, but what are they going to do if the UK ain't ready?
Well, this is the problem. Look, Jean-Claude Juncker.
By the way, may I just note that I don't think we've had any conversation on Brexit that was not preceded by. So,
hey, you're doing laughter too. Lots
yes.
of laughter.
So okay, the laughter okay, and the okay. deep sigh are noted.
All right. So Jean-Claude Juncker, I mean, was actually making in his way a serious point, and he'd become the boogeyman. He is exactly why people voted to Brexit in the first place. He's a besuited fellow, doesn't seem to really do anything, draws down a big salary. He has a neurological problem. So often he's portrayed as being drunk, but he's unsteady on his feet. Okay, so Jean-Claude Juncker says this, and at the official level, the top official level, they've got so much more to discuss in the EU. You have a president of the United States who's clearly isolationist. The security architecture of Europe based in NATO is under threat. Emmanuel Macron this week gave an extraordinary interview to The Economist about, well, you know, maybe we should break up NATO and perhaps forge our own security alliance.
Wait. The president of France suggested that maybe NATO should be.
No, he's saying that NATO is obsolete. Not because, I mean, the French were always
very French,
half-hearted NATO participants. But basically, it's in response to the fact if the U.S. is going to withdraw, who is actually going to provide security? So in the middle of all this, the Brits are having this national nervous breakdown. So October 31st came and went. Boris Johnson said he would die in a ditch if Britain hadn't Brexited by October 31st. Last seen on the campaign trail. He's not in a ditch.
He yet lives.
He yet lives. And it seems that, you know, Britain will probably give him a majority. The polls certainly indicate that. So then the Tories could, in theory, pass Brexit. But the problem is it's only the withdrawal agreement. It's got nothing to do with negotiating the actual new trading terms with the other 27 members who they've just walked out on. And that would probably take the EU negotiated with Canada. It took 5 years to reach agreement and another 2 years to ratify. Now, we've got, for the rest of my life, I want listeners to understand, I will be living through trade negotiations, deadlines, awful stuff. And meanwhile, the European Union wants to go on with more important issues.
Let me back up to Mexico just a bit, because you've shared some more comments with us and one question that I'd like us to get to. Eric commented on our Facebook page, 9 people killed in Mexico. Trump offers a scorched earth assault on the cartels in Mexico. Hundreds of U.S. citizens killed in the U.S. in mass shootings. Trump does nothing. Another listener writes, this has been going on for decades, but no one ever asks where the cartels' guns are coming from. Hint, gun control in the U.S. would impact them. And Rick tweeted, and Nancy, this is an interesting question. Rick tweeted, why not label the cartels a terrorist group?
Well, because I think, and I'm conjecturing, I think the term terrorism is as much a political one as a practical one in terms of how we use the term. And I think, frankly, for the U.S., terrorism is terrorism inflicted on its country, in its borders, more so than I think sort of the terrorism we talk about in terms of, or on its troops, for example. So I think once you label it a terrorism kind of problem, you demand a sort of solution that I'm not sure that policymakers on either the Mexican or U.S. side of the border are prepared to or able to put forth.
Also worth noting, of course, that 8 Mexican citizens were killed in the El Paso mass shooting. So there are other reasons for the U.S. and Mexico to collaborate on cross-border violence. Hayes, were you trying to jump in?
Oh, yeah, just really quickly. I just also want to point out that it's also very – Nancy's right in saying it's a very political term in the sense that usually when the U.S. designates a group as a terrorist, they usually have some sort of political goal in mind versus the cartels, who are mostly economic in nature. Yes, they have some political – they influence politics, but their main goal is money, not necessarily to change the way that the government of Mexico operates.
One last story before we go. It was a remarkable moment that played out in Japan for post-apartheid South Africa. South Africa beat England to take the Rugby World Cup, led by its first black captain in the team's 128-year history. Siya Kolisi told reporters, quote, "We have so many problems in our country, but we come from different backgrounds, different races, and came together with one goal," unquote. Among the post-match celebrations was the poignant sight of the captain, Kolisi, being joined on the podium by South Africa's president, Cyril Ramaphosa. His jersey had the number 6 on the back, which is the number that's worn by South Africa's captain. Hayes, this is a big deal for a country that still has quite a few problems to work through.
Absolutely. Now, I am no rugby expert. I can tell you that a ball moves back and forth on a field as men smash against each other.
It's close
that
enough.
Much I know. But it really is amazing for South Africa to have this moment where they've rallied behind this interracial rugby team who went on to win the World Cup. It's just a really great moment in a country that has needed a really great moment for a minute now with the issues it's struggling with its government and corruption, with its economic stagnation. So, honestly, great for them to see a black captain raising that trophy, no matter how ridiculous the name of the trophy is.
Briefly, Michael, before we go.
And Siya Kolisi, it's worth looking up about him. He had an astonishing life, never had enough to eat as a kid. He's now become the symbol of South Africa. He's got a beautiful family. And it was a tremendous moment in world sport in what was an unbelievably brutal and violent game.
Michael Goldfarb, host of the podcast First Rough Draft of History. Michael, thanks for joining us from Washington.
My pleasure.
Hayes Brown, the Deputy World News Editor for BuzzFeed News. Thank you, Hayes.
Glad to be here.
And Nancy Youssef, National Security Reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you.
Our senior producers are Danielle Knight and Paige Osborne. You can learn more about our team online at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for your questions and your remembrances of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.